All right, our next speakers, it's a team of three, all from the DNR. They're going to be talking on groundwater thresholds and modeling the impact, which sounds very fun to me. And the three speakers are Jason Meckel, who's a manager of the Inventory and Monitoring Analysis section. Glenn Champion is a hydrologist with the Hydrogeology and Groundwater Unit. And Ian Chisholm is the supervisor of the River Ecology Unit. There's a lot more in here, but in the interest of time, we'll just move on. Thank you.
Those that don't know, I'm Jason. I want to thank the speakers before. They did a nice job of setting this up. I do want to say that there's been a lot of applause for the speakers, but I want, as scientists in the room, you all to applaud yourself for choosing the noble profession of being a scientist. So please applaud yourselves. Many of you may be sporting sunburns from the march last Saturday. My role as a section manager at the DNR is that I get to manage a section of 140 scientists, give or take, plus a bunch of student interns and temporary hires during the summer, that go out and collect data. They collect data on water levels, they collect data on fish and on plants and all kinds of other species, and then we try to make sense of that data and help inform big, big decisions with the big, big data. We're going to focus today on some of the big decisions that the DNR's charged with making and how we're approaching that. This is a work in progress. You're going to see data that is not published. It's preliminary. But in the interest of advancing the profession, we felt that it was important to share with you where we're at and what we're doing and how we're going about that. Before I start, I do want to say and acknowledge Steve Thompson, who retired from the DNR a little while back. Steve's in the audience. We can blame him for some of the mess. I'm kidding. Steve had a strong vision, and you've heard about some of that vision here this morning, and he built it on the vision of others that preceded him and Jenny Leet. But one of the things that Steve did was convince me that we should, in fact, support an aquifer test database. So we found the money to make sure that we could do that, and Todd has carried that on. Todd Peterson, who was in here this morning, talking about that. So you all make a difference. Now, the one thing, I'm not going to say anything political, but I do want you to understand that the Senate and the House are working on a budget, and they're working with the governor on that budget. And right now, the Senate's budget does not provide the funding for us to maintain a bunch of the programs that were talked about this morning. Now, I'm hopeful that that's going to change. But if you're so motivated as to want to share your perspective about the value of that kinds of data with somebody that might represent you in this beautiful, beautiful place of St. Paul, feel inclined to do so. So I'm going to set the context for this, and Ian's going to follow and talk about stream ecology and hydrology and how we're trying to bring that information to bear on appropriation permit decisions of all things. And then Glenn is going to talk about how we're using hydrogeology models, groundwater models, to evaluate how pumping and groundwater withdrawal may be affecting the flow for the fish that are trying to live in those ecosystems. So with that, let's see here. I'm going to try to advance. I have talked a lot about groundwater. I'm not a hydrogeologist. I had a hydrogeology course in college, but I hated calculus. So I got much more interested in the surface water aspects of things and started snorkeling and looking at trout in the middle of winter in streams in Montana. And that's ultimately what brought me to Minnesota. And this is one of our beautiful trout streams in southeastern Minnesota that is highly, highly dependent on groundwater to maintain that ecosystem. So why do we even care? Why are we even asking these questions? Well, the trend that we've seen is that, generally speaking, over time, we're using more groundwater to meet our people needs. This is part of our economic development, our economy, it's our drinking water and so forth. So the question is, can we continue to use this much groundwater? What if we continue to grow and we add more people to this place and we start to use more and more groundwater? Are we going to have any problems? So we began in real earnest trying to figure out, well, where indeed do we have some of those problems? Now, it's one thing to think about the groundwater use, but it's another thing to think about it in space and what these, this should be. Is it animating? I hope it is. So as you watch this, you'll see that the shades get darker. Lindsay, are you here somewhere in the room? Yes, Lindsay in the back created this for us. Nothing up here is of my creation. I say this is all from the incredible staff that work in our section. But this is showing you well density, and it's how it's changing over time. And so this starts to give us some insight about the challenge that we face, which is we tend to use water intensively around certain kinds of activities. Generally speaking, it's either agriculture or us, people. In some cases, some industry in our state. So Ian and some of his staff in our stream flow and rivers group started to ask the question, well, how much of the water are we pulling away from surface water ecosystems when we're withdrawing that water? And they started to come up with ways of trying to estimate, you know, what's the fraction of water that's falling on this place that might be flowing through the system, and then how much are we pulling out? And what this map is showing is that basically red areas, we're pulling a pretty significant fraction of the water away and we're using it, we're consuming it. It's not going back into the system. So we started to use this and say, well, you know, these are probably the places where we ought to be investing some more energy in terms of understanding what's happening and consider whether or not authorizing more appropriation of water really makes sense given what we're starting to understand here. You know, the yellow areas may be a little less of a concern and the orange and so on and so forth, but a valuable tool. There are three black lines or polygons, if you will, on this map, so I'll just say a moment about those. Those are our three groundwater management areas. We have just completed the third plan. One is up in the Parker Rapids area. It's the Strait River. The Bonanza Valley plan was completed just about a year ago, and the North and East Metro plan was completed just before that. These are all plans that say DNR, this is what DNR is going to do here. We're going to get better data. We're going to do better analysis. We're going to review the permits. We're going to talk with people, and we're going to try to figure out, is this use sustainable? And if it's not, what changes need to happen? It's a five-year plan. We're partway into the progress of implementing those. All of this is predicated on the fact that we have a responsibility given to us by the legislature that says basically when we authorize people to use water, when we issue a permit, you have to get a permit if you're going to use more than 1 million gallons, we have to consider these things. Now this is just, I've bulletized statute because if you've ever read statute, it's not very fun. Basically says we have to consider the current and projected water levels. So we need to use models, and we use aquifer tests, and we use all kinds of data to try to project those water levels. We have to consider water quality. Frankly, we're getting better at that, but it's a really challenging thing, as I think everybody in this room probably appreciates. How will pumping over there affect water quality over here and somebody in between, and what about the contaminants, and what don't we know, and how does it move? What we're going to focus on today is how do we protect ecosystems. How is it that in a state with 15,000 real lakes and some major rivers with water flowing out all over the place, can we be concerned about water? And the question is really one about time and space. How much water are we using in a given area over what time, and how is that affecting a surface water ecosystem in some way? And then the last thing is we have to think about the future generations meeting their needs. Now, for us, that really sort of it means, well, let's plan out at least many decades and project out many decades. What is this going to look like if this kind of activity continues? So the way I translate this is into a flow chart of, well, so if then kind of thing. So here's my if then. So we need to do some math. We need to do some analysis with all the data that we can get our hands on. We do things like drawdown estimates. How is pumping here going to affect somebody else's well over there? Simple kinds of things. We need to do depletion estimates. How will pumping here affect the water level in that wetland, lake, or stream? Sometimes we have to use really complex models, and Glenn's going to describe an example of that. And then we're starting to incorporate more and more our understanding of stream flow. How does this all come together? How is it affecting the ecosystem? So in a very simple sense, we start off with number one. We say, well, there's not a lot of pumping here. We don't think we're crossing a threshold. You know what? We can go ahead and issue that permit. And then we can continue to collect some data. And at some point we say, you know, let's go back and redo the analysis. Maybe things have changed over time. This has been the history of the mostly what I would say 9,000 plus permits issued in the state of Minnesota. A belief that we hadn't crossed a threshold, we'd go ahead and issue the permit, but we'll continue to collect data. And somewhere down the road, somebody will come back and we'll actually analyze this and revisit these questions. What we really are typically in is what I call box two, which is insufficient data. Even though we have a lot of data, we have insufficient data in many cases at the spatial scale and resolution that we really need it. So then the decision is, do we issue a permit? Do we issue it conditionally? Do we issue it for a certain period of time? And then we gather more data, and we go back to our box in the middle, and we do some analysis, and then we revisit the decisions we'd made. What we're on the verge of is really what I think is called box, what I call loop number three, and that is that we find ourselves above a threshold. We're having some kind of an effect that society says we don't want to tolerate. And we're going to talk about what that is. And the statutes and the rules say you need to set some protected flows, you need to set some protected elevations, you got to protect these ecosystems. DNR, that's your job. And that's what we're in the process of figuring out how to do. And inevitably, if we find ourselves above a threshold, what that's going to mean is that we have a conflict. There's not enough water to meet the requests that exist, and we're going to have to resolve it. And statute says you resolve it by allocating that water amongst the priorities according to statute. Drinking water, number one. I'm sure you're all happy about that. And then subsequent after that, we get to agriculture, and we got power generation. And then lawn watering is actually down at the very bottom. Probably no surprise. It's not a high priority item in statute, even though we tend to use a lot of it for it. Okay, so I'm going to turn this over to Ian, and he's going to talk about the stream ecology. Again, I just want to remind you that this is preliminary information. Don't run out of the room going, oh, DNR set this number at this, and here's what's going to happen, and here we go, right? But we think it's valuable to share this with all of you in the room. I did fail to mention that this is based on the work that you're going to hear about is in part of what we described to in a report to the legislature on what we call the thresholds of negative impact. Our approach to how do we think we can do what the statutes tell us we need to do. And I will come at the very end if we've got any time left and offer a summary thought or two.
Good morning. Okay. So this is sort of the outline of my talk. Jason's really covered the first piece, which is sustainability, accounting for ecosystems and future generations. Those two are equated. Secondly, I'm going to talk about that threshold, and it's key. The threshold for ecological health and sustainability, identifying that is a key piece. And lastly, the terms, the management prescriptions are the terms of meeting that threshold and maintaining ecosystem health and sustainability. So first, responsibility then to talk about today after Jason was identifying a threshold for ecological health. And if you look at this conceptually, this process at the top here, let's see if I can operate this. Okay, that doesn't work. At the top gradient there, you pass from top gradient of human influence on biological condition, you go from where severe disturbance leaves nothing alive. At the other end, on the right, you have pristine conditions and very little disturbance, and that equates to biological integrity. That parallel gradient then on the bottom moves from biological integrity, and at the far left of that, nothing alive again. At some point, there is a threshold where you are changing the system and moving from healthy and sustainable conditions towards disease or unhealthy. So there's been some work done and published in 2011 trying to look at exactly what are the thresholds for stream ecosystems. And this is an illustration of that. Conceptually, you have in front of you there a blue line which represents the hydrograph of an idealized stream. And this is the baseline condition. The red dotted line, then, as we deplete the stream by 10%, you still can't see impacts. And so it's believed that up to 10% withdrawal or change in that ecosystem has no discernible impact and would represent a high degree of protection for the ecosystem. And this has been written up in just one citation there at the bottom, Ackerman and Ferguson. As we move to 20%, however, a number of authors have documented problems, and we get to where we are known. We have known impacts to that ecosystem, and change is probable. So that then begins to define the DNR's threshold for maintenance of ecosystem integrity, and sustainability, somewhere between 10 and 20%. So the next task then is to translate those, that threshold into actual terms that we can manage by. And so here the question is, very simply, what is the hydrology that will maintain the current system in healthy conditions? And there's been a lot of different ones that have been tried over time, and I won't get into those for the sake of time here. Suffice to say that what people are all over the world are starting to gravitate towards or move towards is a percentage of flow approach. And the reason for this is that it's conceptually simple. There it is. Provides protection for natural flow variability, which is key to ecosystems, stream ecosystems in particular. And it's relatively simple to implement. So when we talk about percentage of flow, what are we talking about? Percentage of what flow? Well, August is a key month biologically. It's critical. It's a low flow month. It's also part of the growing season where we have most of our groundwater pumping occurring. And it represents a biological bottleneck. It actually determines, low flows in August determine species richness in our state. And this conclusion is based on some work we did, Dan O'Shea did, where he did some regression with stream length, position, substrate and width, and mean August flow. There's over 700 sample sites representing stations across the Minnesota. And what he found was low flows predict species richness, and smaller streams were more sensitive to changes than larger streams. And this is important because first-order streams, the very small ones that you can jump across, represent 51% of our streams by length in Minnesota. 73% of our streams are first- and second-order streams. So it's a big deal when we manage to know these kind of things. Why then, or how do we begin to translate this, refine this notion of flows and low flows regulating our stream communities? How can we translate this and to refine it down to where we can actually say this is the correct level? And we use fish habitat to be able to look at that. Why? First of all, frankly, we have a lot of information on fish habitat. And secondly, fish have capitalized in every habitat type in streams. We have a lot of data. They're all over the place and doing things in streams. And also, so therefore, we're using them as surrogates for the entire ecosystem. They are not, they represent much more than just that little darter or something that we see an impact in. That darter represents, for example, a rainbow darter or long-nosed ace, represents the riffle habitat, fast riffle habitat, which is used by a whole bunch of species and invertebrates. It is, riffles, for example, are a biological hotspot. So this is a very important concept. And when we talk about elements that are important for the purpose of modeling stream ecosystems, what are we talking about? And of course, here I have a diagram or a schematic of cross-section of a stream with riffles, pools, actually glides, runs, riffles, pools, and the water levels. And then, of course, as I just mentioned, all sorts of biological activity, and most of the invertebrate production is occurring in these riffles, which then, through the process of drift, float over all the other habitats. And of course, there's a whole bunch of species that associated themselves with these food sources and this riffle habitat. And then they're capitalized on by, or fed on by even other species. So we have really a very complicated, complex, and this is a simplified version of a food web. And this is just talking about fish. So you can layer on top of things here the chemical activity, the chemical biological interactions, invertebrates, all sorts of things here. But one of the important things to note is that even if I just care about my large game fish, I see real quickly here, if I look at this, that they're connected to all the little guys that I may think are nothing, not very important. Quite frankly, we are blessed in Minnesota. We've been collecting data on fish habitat, which is defined as hydraulically as depth, velocity, substrate, and cover. We've been collecting data since 1987. We've got over 220,000 individual observations representing over 10,000 samples, 129 species in our streams, and have generated 150 species life stage curves. So we've got a wealth of information here. And in fact, there's so much information and so much species in our streams that we really have to figure out a way to boil that down. And this was first published in 1988 by Leonard North, but this habitat guild approach was used by Odland to take all of our data and compile it into these six habitat types and streams. And so we use this then to model the effect of flow on habitat. And this is a graph for all of our data, 159 habitat-based response curves for August, 63 species, 9 streams. And on the bottom here, you have a proportion of the index flow removed, and right here, this is habitat. So as you remove flow, habitat is decreased for these species. A few not so, a few more so. And in fact, this has been found in other places as well. What you have on the black lines there is the Michigan's abundance-based response curves, very similar. The red dots represent the groundwater systems advisory threshold, and the blue crosses represent what the Michigan legislature end up recommending for warm water streams. So, but the point here is that this relationship of habitat to flow for fish species or for populations to flow is something that is substantiated all over. This is Little Rock Creek. We do not have a lot of data on Little Rock Creek, but we happen to have one stream gauging transect. And so we wanted to go ahead and look at what this relationship would look like with that transect. And what you have here are three of our habitat guilds, fast riffle, raceway, and slow riffle. The species there and the relationship as you remove the index flow, what happens to habitat. And what we see is at the 10% of the August median base flow, this is the relationship. You have somewhere between 0 to 20% habitat remaining. If we look at 20% of the August median base flow, we're looking at 0 to 40% of the habitat. So 60% remaining, 40% lost. And of course, you know, this represents, this is not a complete study for this in any stretch. Much more work is needed, but this is an indicator of the kind of relationship that we'd be examining and reporting on. Also, for the sake of comparison here, I've got plotted 10% of the average flow in August and 20%. And here you see very different, we're at the low end of habitat remaining for those values. So the solid black line is currently represents the modeled depletion level where we're currently at in that little stream. What flow then serves as this index flow for management? So the terms that we're going to use to try to maintain our threshold. Here I have a table of August daily flows and August base flows. And August base flows is something that we're gravitating towards at this point. And so these two are side-by-side comparisons of these typical statistics. August average flow is higher and more variable than median base flow. Median daily and median August base flow are very, very similar, 7.8 to 7.3. And August median base flow is a flow that regularly occurs, and August mean does not. What do I mean by that? Well, here I have the two distributions on the left, daily flows in August, and on the right, base flows in August. And these are the means, 26 and 16 CFS. And these distribution plots, this is a box whisker plot. 50% of the values are represented in the box, and the black lines are the median flow. As you can see, between these two, very similar median flows, and the means are way up in the whiskers, rarely occurring. So, plotted another way. When we look at the duration curve for Little Rock Creek, we see the 7.8 CFS median August flow has now been changed. When you take into account the model depletion, we're now looking at 5.3 CFS, which used to be, without depletion, our 90% exceedance value. We're changing the hydrograph out there. To some extent, you have to say, okay, you're changing it. Is it meaningful? If it's over 20%, we believe it's meaningful, and that's what the science supports right now. So, and lastly, I just wanted to show where August is in terms of the growing season. And obviously, for the growing season months, it is the lowest month there. There are other months that are even lower that occur during winter. And finally, this approach, is this something totally novel? No. This is being used in other states and even in Europe. It's being used other places. Two examples so that you can see it here. Michigan, their ecological goal there is to maintain baseline or existing condition. They allow 6 to 15% of August median flow use. And another one, Florida, where they use daily flows, allows 8 to 19% of daily flows. And keep in mind, they have a very active management system in Florida. There's a lot of communication engaging on both sides of the monitoring and use. So that's what is required for using daily flow statistics. And that's all I have. Glenn is next.
Okay, so I'm going to go into the Little Rock Creek example a little bit more and kind of describing briefly where those numbers came from that Ian just showed you. I know, you know, a lot of you are groundwater hydrologists and engineers and are interested in more of the details of, you know, a study like this, and we're going to have to kind of gloss over a lot of the hydrogeology and just talk about the process more here. But so, oops. Okay, so this is just showing you where we are in the state for this for Little Rock Creek. It's north of St. Cloud. The black outline is our study area, and it's also the boundaries of the groundwater model. And the area shaded in is kind of a focus area that our initial kind of narrowing of the focus area of where we wanted to look at use and impacts. The dashed line, dark blue lines are the designated trout streams. Little Rock Creek is the main stream there, and Bunker Hill Creek is a tributary. So what are the concerns here? It's groundwater use that's increased over time. How is that, and we're really focusing in on how that's impacting Little Rock Creek. There are other features that we may also be interested in the future. So this is just a quick look within that shaded area that we're calling the focus area. The blue line is the cumulative number of permits issued over time for all water appropriations within that focus area. And that was just generated by the fiscal year that a permit was issued and all the list of permits, which we can look up in our water use database. Some of those permits may have been issued and then later terminated, so it's not necessarily the total number of permits that are actually active at any time. That would be harder to regenerate. And we have electronic data of reported water use going back to 1988, and that line is the total reported water use for permit holders within the focus area. So it really went up about 2,000 with big fluctuations with the weather since then. Over 90% of the use is for agricultural irrigation. There are some other uses in the area. So this is simplified geology of the area. The dark green are areas of mostly till of northeast provenance, superior lobe, and the tan is all the different surficial sand units aggregated together. And you can see the dark green dots are agricultural irrigation wells in the Empire's database, and blue is all other groundwater permits. You can see they're concentrated mostly in the sand area, but there are some others where you've got irrigation on soils formed over till. So the geologic atlases that Bob talked about earlier, there's one for Morrison County, which is the north half of the study area, and one for Benton County, the south half of the area. They aren't quite, there are actually some significant differences between those, and they were done at different times, so that was one thing that we had to do. But so I'm not going to go over this in detail, but just there's one cross-section from the southern part of Morrison County, and I have a blow-up showing where Little Rock Creek is. The tan are sands, the green are northwest provenance tills, and the kind of pink colors are northeast provenance tills. So the picture is just, there's a bunch of different discontinuous sand units in between a bunch of different till layers. So the geology is that kind of typical complexity of central Minnesota. And that's all I'm going to say about that. We don't have a lot of time to go into detail. So. The study area data, there are more data here than we typically have if you just go to any watershed in Minnesota and look for, you know, what do we have for stream monitoring, observation wells with fairly long records, other accurate measurements of water levels with, you know, known times and carefully measured, it's surveyed well elevations, and pumping tests. There are quite a few, if you combine all kind of single well tests and full bore aquifer tests with a decent amount of data, that were, there are 20-something of those. But if you're thinking about the density of data compared to the heterogeneity and complexity of the system, I'd have to say it's still low to moderate, but way better than we usually have. And you could layer on this CWI. We chose to really de-emphasize CWI for the modeling effort because the data are a little more all over the place, and we had a higher density of good quality data here than we usually have. Let me go back here and to focus. We're going to be mostly focusing on. Do I have the cursor here? This one stream gauge, marked by the cursor there, that has a longer-term data set with at least some data going back to 1998. And a more continuous data set starting in 2008. And so we'll look at that one next. So this is a hydrograph of all the data available at that stream gauge. The blue line is total daily flows from stream gauge. The red is a empirically filtered base flow using the WHAT. Base flow filter. There are a lot of other filters that were tested here too, and you get some significant differences. You get a range. And the black dots are actual field measurements. So what do we need to do to understand the impact of water use on stream base flow? We're really focused on, just the connection between, I stole this figure from a USGS manual for the GS flow, which combines a conceptual watershed model with mod flow, and they're linked. So I stole the figure for kind of showing some of the processes that we need to understand, because we need to understand the whole hydrologic system to compare historical data to model data and understand that we're actually modeling the connection between pumping and stream flow in the context of everything that's going on. So I added on to that, you know, frozen soils, an important process in early spring, well pumping, irrigation, and an important aspect of irrigation is the return of increased recharge under irrigated fields. It's pretty significant according to the model and other analyses that have been done. And other things that are important to note on here, you know, ET directly from the water table is a significant part of the water budget in summer. And, you know, both Hortonian overland flow, flow caused by, you know, rainfall intensity exceeding the infiltration rate, but probably a more important runoff generation process for splitting out how much did you have runoff and how much do you have infiltration is saturation excess flow, where you get water and you get a lot of runoff from areas that are temporarily saturated. So you need to understand that to split runoff from recharge and infiltration. So the approach that we chose, partly out of kind of the tools that we had available and expertise, was to combine the gridded watershed model, GSSHA or GEISHA, developed by the Army Corps of Engineers. We have expertise in that. And so I wanted to split up the duties on this modeling approach, modeling groundwater and surface water as a combined system. Wanted so tap our expertise on that, and our surface water modeler said, well, if I'm going to do it, it's going to be in GEISHA. And it turns out that does what we need, but we had to be able to merge that with a 3D groundwater model to model reasonably well the complex hydrogeological system. So we use ModFlow USG for that, which is a integrated finite difference version of ModFlow. So GEISHA models the soils, overland flow, and has a 2D saturated groundwater component too. And then can extract from that net groundwater recharge minus groundwater evapotranspiration and plug that into ModFlow as recharge. And this is just a kind of a token figure of the whole modeling process. I'm not going to go into all the details. You know, one thing that you typically look at is the head residuals, and there's a modeled water table map. So we went through a whole process of calibrating the model, revising our conceptual model a little bit, and we're going to jump right over all that interesting stuff, to, at least to me, to the results. So again, we're focusing on that one stream gauge with the longer term data set. And here we have monthly simulated base flow with all the reported groundwater use and the net effect of that, including the irrigation return flows that are modeled in GEISHA, and a simulation without the irrigation water use. So what do? We just subtract those two numbers and you get the depletion of, you know, the system compared to a kind of its potential base flow that could happen without the water use. Now there are some choices and complexity in the details of that non-pumping scenario, because it's not just the pumping that affects the hydrology, land use, things like that. And so, you know, we're in the process of testing some of those assumptions and seeing how sensitive it is to the choices that you make for especially that non-pumping scenario. So you subtract those two numbers to get the simulated depletion, but then we want to bring that back to the actual measured flow, because simulated flow is, you know, we did the best we could, but it's still a simulation. So this is adding the simulated depletion back into the measured flows. So at the top is base flow and separated base flow, and the bottom is total flow, and with the simulated depletion added back into the total flow. And that's, again, shown here at the monthly time scale. And that's where those numbers came from that Ian was showing earlier, what he was calling total flow and total base flow are adding that modeled depletion back into the actual measured flow. And he already described the results, but I've just pulled out this key factor here is that our calculated August monthly depletion for those years when we had measurements overlapping with our simulation period, 2006 and 2008 through 14. Both the mean amount of depletion and the median are greater than 35% of the August median base flow, and it's pretty similar for the August total flow, since Ian showed you in August, if you're looking at the median, the base flow and total flow are pretty close. The distribution is just really skewed for the occasional, the mean's really skewed because of the occasional high flows in August. So that's just, in a nutshell, you know, just describing the process that for a large system with lots of users, trying to understand what's going on, the only way to tackle that is with a full hydrologic flow model that models the whole system. But I should step back for a moment and just, you know, I forgot to mention this earlier, but looking at the issue of scale, you know, we're looking at a stream gauge that integrates flow over a fairly large area, and that's the scale that we're looking at. We don't want to exaggerate, you know, what we can do at a much smaller scale with the data that we have. The heterogeneity is pretty significant out there. We have a lot of aquifer tests, and you might have an aquifer test in one aquifer, one location and a mile away, an aquifer test in a different aquifer, and you know, they're 70% different transmissivities, and you know, and we don't have detail on that everywhere. We have a pretty good geological model, but we think at the scale of a flow gauge that integrates a significant amount of the area that the modeling is pretty effective, but we're not going to exaggerate that we could model a 1 mile segment of the stream and what's the impact of this 1 mile that's 3 miles away with a high degree of accuracy. So that's kind of, that should be kept in mind when planning, you know, what's even possible or reasonable to do with this kind of thing. So in the future, where are we going to go with this? Well, we're going to do a little bit more work to look at sensitivities of some of our assumptions on the modeling results. But then once that's set up, we have to say, well, what are we going to look at for alternatives to the net, you know, water use scenario out there? One thing that the users wanted us to look at is mitigation, so we will do that. Pumping water out of the ground and dumping it into the stream at, you know, one or more locations to mitigate the impact during the critical periods. Another is, you know, so far we've only looked at aggregate, the impact of pumping across the and use across the whole system, and how does that affect base flow at a couple of stream gauges. But what are the spatial relationships? Again, I don't think we can narrow that down to well by well and have that accurate, but maybe it, you know, there are certainly spatial relationships, and here I just stole another figure from a USGS information circular that you're all familiar with, the fact that, you know, groundwater is kind of a filter, a hydraulic filter. So if you have This figure shows just a simple situation where you have a stream with wells at, in A shows a cyclic pumping with the same amount of pumping for 3 months over the summer, a year, or a constant pumping rate that's the same total annual volume. In B, you have the stream flow depletion caused by a well with the pumping regimes in A, 300 feet from a stream. It's an unconfined aquifer. This is not a semi-confined aquifer like most of the aquifers in the Little Rock area. C is at 1,000 feet. D is 3,000 feet. So, you know, both the timing and magnitude are spread out. And, you know, if you look at the well 3,000 feet away, it takes, you know, maybe more than 10 years for a complete equilibrium and at least 5 years to get most of the way to the impact, whereas the one that's 300 feet away, the seasonal impacts happen pretty much at the same time as the pumping. So looking at that in a little more detail in the Little Rock area with, to the degree we can, without exaggerating the spatial accuracy of the model, will be helpful for evaluating management scenarios. So I'll turn it back to Jason for a few closing remarks.
All right, thanks, Glenn and Ian. I just want to say that the challenge here is we're trying to bring a lot of technical information into a public policy decision-making setting. So the example that we just provided to you is an area of the state where agricultural producers are extremely dependent on the ability to use this water to grow crops. So the seriousness with which we have to approach this work is significant. We've formed an advisory committee in the Little Rock Creek area with agricultural irrigators, other folks, local units of government, and other interests, so that we can share with them the work that we're doing along the way and engage in dialogue about how to do this and do it in the best way that we can. We formed a technical advisory committee to help make sure that the modeling work we're doing and the way we're applying and using the techniques is appropriate for the particular setting. And I want to acknowledge that I think I saw at least three of our technical advisory committee members in the room, Kelton Barr, Dan Whitney, and Jim Stark. I don't know if I missed anybody else, but pardon me? Mark Collins, thank you. They agreed to donate some time, and we don't take that lightly. They'll be reviewing a report on some of the modeling work that we've done. But this is kind of cutting edge stuff for the state of Minnesota. But we think we're going about it in the right way. We think we're going about it in a rational way. We think we're using the best available science to help us get there. It is remarkably slow. It takes a while. But I think we're making great progress. So I think we're getting close to lunch. I don't know if there is time or not for questions, Evan. And then I know I'll be around for the panel. I think Ian and Glenn will as well. So, thank you.
That was great. Thank you. Yes, we do have time for a few questions.
For anybody.
How is that 10% threshold applied? I mean, it's 10% reduction based on the August low flow. Is that a volume that's the same that could be removed from the stream all year, or does that volume that's allowed to be removed change in other parts of the year when there's more water available?
So the idea is that it's because of the way we use water, we're not anticipating adjusting withdrawal rates weekly, monthly, that kind of thing. So the time frame is we authorize a volume of water to be appropriated, and we want users to be able to count on that for some period of time. So it's really what's the effect of that use going to be on that August flow. 10% is where we say not probably a concern if it's below that. If it's above 20, we're definitely concerned, and we got to figure out for each location or each stream where we think we really need to be. Oh, guys, we're hungry. Everybody wants to go to lunch.
This is a Jason question about a known unknown. Global warming. There's some long-term likely transition for ecology and hydrology. Any thoughts about tracking that, at least informally, in these kinds of management situations?
Well, I can think of a variety of things related to the way our climate's changing. I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question about tracking it, but I'll describe what I think the challenge is that we have to deal with, as I understand it, and that is that for our lake systems, they already are going to have less ice. That means they evaporate more. So how do we factor in the fact that more water is just going up through the atmosphere than typically would have been the case? For our stream systems, the flow variability is likely to increase because of the change in the way the precipitation is coming. To a degree, that's probably also going to result in some temperature changes, and for some systems, that's going to be a critical factor. And where you have a transition zone from cold water to warm water, you have a cool water deal, and that zone is likely going to move in these systems over time. The one I'm particularly interested in, and we've talked about this within our Metropolitan Water Supply Advisory Technical Group, is how is recharge going to change? You know, so much of the modeling that we do, and Glenn talked about this, but briefly, is, well, there's some recharge estimating that we're doing, because we don't measure it. And if recharge changes substantially, not even substantially, just a little bit, but continuously over time, it seems to me that we could have dramatic effects on aquifer levels. And I think that's a question that this group will likely help contribute answers to. How do we factor that in? What does that mean 50, 60 years from now? If the growing season's longer and the recharge season gets maybe shorter or compressed and the rain falls and comes at different times, you know, when you get past the root zone, right, get past the vegetation in that recharge, I think there's a lot to be learned about that. And I'm not a hydrogeologist. So.
All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Oh, there's a question right
more.
There.
Sorry.
We got to end with three. Good things come in three, right?
My question was, do you take temperature into account when building those thresholds? Because as you decrease the flow, those warm waters are going to stay there and elevate the temperatures for your index species, which are the fish.
Great question. We didn't talk about it here, but one of the other things we're going to do this summer, so Ian's going to go out with his crew. They're going to do more of these habitat measurements on Little Rock Creek. And we haven't even had a chance to talk about this with our advisory committee. And so, you know, this is stuff that we're just still formulating. But they're going to go out and get more habitat measurements. We're going to do some diatrace and water temperature modeling as well, so that we're trying to get a better handle on time of travel in the system and how changes in flow affect water temperature. So, yeah, great question. A lot to be considered. We only gave you a slice of it today.
Can I do one follow-up to that?
Yes.
So, relating to, how does this study relate to the TMDL that was recently done on Little Rock Creek?
So Little Rock Creek has a TMDL. It's impaired for dissolved oxygen, biota, and nitrates. And the TMDL study said that they think groundwater pumping and the modeling work that was done was a contributing factor to that. So what we're trying to figure out is if there is changes in the pumping regime out there and the flows increase, how might that improve the water quality conditions and the biota, et cetera? They're linked, but they're not directly linked. I mean, we've used information from that study to help inform our work.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.